All right, I am so glad you're here, and on a holiday weekend, I had no idea how many would be here. I normally try to keep elders from preaching in the summer on holiday weekends because I don't want them to preach to an empty room, but maybe some of them actually don't appreciate that. They might rather preach to an empty room, but I'm so glad you're here, and I want to preach today from Genesis. And it's a little bit of a character study of Jacob, and my goal is to show you the development of Jacob's faith in three stages. The first stage would be where God was irrelevant to Jacob. The second stage would be where God was useful. And then the third stage would be where God was essential. And so I want to just take us through the life of Jacob and see these three stages that God is working out in his life. And so you can turn to Genesis 28 or so, and that will get you in the ballpark. I'm going to start before there, but I won't read until we get to 28. So Isaac was a son of Abraham, and Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. And they were twins. They were born simultaneously. And the two babies were struggling in the womb of his mother. And when they came out, Jacob was born second, but he was grasping the heel of his older brother Esau. And so he was given the name Jacob, and Jacob, the name means supplanter. Now, for about 90% of us in the room, we have no idea what a supplanter is. And so I looked it up myself. I had a vague idea. And a supplanter is someone who takes over by force or treachery. It has the idea of someone taking someone else's rightful place, replacing them through force or treachery. That's what it means to supplant someone. And Jacob was named supplanter, and so you get the idea of the way his career is going to unfold based on his name. Okay, so stage one for Jacob lasts 77 years. That's a long time. And we would think I don't know, if you're 77, are you old yet? No, I got a lot of 78-year-olds shaking their heads and 80-year-olds. So he's not very old, he's only 77. And but he lived the first 77 years of his life with God being irrelevant. And so as a young man, he was, the text doesn't say he was actually jealous, but his actions reveal that he was jealous and that he wished he had been the firstborn. And when you're the firstborn in this culture, you have certain responsibilities as the head of the family. The oldest son is going to eventually be the head of the entire family. And in order to give the older son the resources that he needs to be the head of the family and take care of his mother and extended family, the older son is given this thing called a birthright. And all the birthright is a double portion of all the resources. So in this case, there were two brothers, and when the father would pass away, all of his resources would be divided into three, and the oldest son would get two of those portions, and the younger son would only get one portion. And so basically, it's a financial windfall, even though it brings responsibility, it's a financial windfall to be the oldest son, to have the birthright. Well, Jacob wanted the birthright, and these boys were very different. Jacob was a disciplined man. If you read his career, you'll see he had a lot of self-discipline. And he was gifted. and what he lacked in sort of brute strength was easily overcome by his wit and daring. So because he was disciplined, he was ruled more by goals than passions. And Esau, on the other hand, was a very passionate man and not very disciplined. And so Esau comes in very hungry one day, and Jacob happens to have food on the table, but he's not just willfully sharing with his brother. And Esau says, "Man, I'm dying here. Give me some of that food." And Jacob says, "Okay, you can have it, but you got to sell me your birthright." And Jacob, just so hungry in the moment, didn't look past that to how much it was actually going to cost him. Traded. Am I saying the wrong words, Denise? Thank you. Y'all know what I mean. Everybody, right? Yeah. I swear, you have to interpret me. You can't just listen to what I say. Yeah. So thanks, Denise, for the head shake. So yeah, Esau wants his food, and he wants it now. So he trades, you know, 2/3 of all of his father's estate for a bowl of lentil stew. And so Jacob obtains the birthright. Then not only was he disciplined, but he was also smart and sneaky and willing to sort of follow bad advice. And so there's one other big thing that the oldest son was going to get, and that was the blessing. And I don't know that Jacob wanted the blessing all that bad, but his mother wanted it for him. And I can't get into the story, but God had told her already that Jacob was going to be the one who was blessed, and that the older would serve the younger. But anyway, the father wanted to give the blessing to Esau, so he sent him out to hunt game. When Jacob's mother found out about it, she organized an elaborate deception with her son. And she made a meal that would taste like wild game. She dressed him up in Esau's clothes, put fur garments, Esau's clothes on him, furry garments, because Esau was a hairy man. Anyway, Jacob goes in to see his father with this meat and pretends to be Esau, and Isaac gives the blessing to Jacob. And so when Esau finds out about it, he was obviously very upset, and he was so upset that he determined to kill his brother. And so Jacob, in a way, kind of has what he wanted, but at great relational cost. And so his mother, wanting to protect him, wants to send him away to protect him, and she sends him to her I guess it's her brother, Laban, in where Abraham was from. And so he's actually going back to his most ancient relatives, and he goes there to get a wife, but also to get away from Esau. And sometimes Jacob is kind of perceived as a little bit of a wimp, but he's actually not. If you just read the text, it's actually a very courageous thing to do, to journey from Canaan alone all the way back to an area sort of near the Euphrates. It was a perilous journey, and Jacob took it. Granted, there was trouble at home, but he was also a courageous, hardworking man. And basically, let me just keep going. So on his way to Laban, he has his first encounter with God. And that's what I want us to look at first in the text. So look at Genesis 28 and verse 10. So Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and laid down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed. And behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And this Jacob's ladder is famous, and this ladder or stairway to heaven is the famous part of this vision or this dream, but it's not the important part of this dream. The ladder to heaven was actually important because of what the next verse says. And behold, the Lord stood above it. See, he didn't just see a ladder. He saw God. He saw Yahweh. And said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth and spread abroad to the west and the east and the north and the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised. So, Jacob began his life with God being irrelevant. And now on his way from Beersheba to Haran, God reveals himself in a very unmistakable way to Jacob. And this brings Jacob into the second stage of his relationship with God that lasts for about a period of 20 years. And the way I would describe this is Jacob comes to understand that God is. God is real. God exists. Therefore, he cannot be irrelevant. So, he concludes, maybe God can be useful. Now, I'll show you that right here in the text, because having had this encounter with God in a dream, but having had this encounter with God in a dream, Jacob is going to proceed to make a deal with God. Okay, and look at the deal that he makes here, beginning in verse 18. Well, I'll read 17. I might as well read 16. Then Jacob awoke from his... Y'all are so patient with me. I love you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. And this is how he gets this revelation, but look at the way he responds to that revelation. So early in the morning, Jacob took a stone that he had put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on top of it. And he called the name of the place Bethel, which means house of God. And the name of the city was Luz at first. But Jacob made a vow. This is what happened. Jacob makes a vow. Look at this. If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone, which I have set up for a pillar, shall be God's house. And of all that you have given to me, I will give a full tenth to you. Do you see the deal that he made with God? Basically saying, God, if you'll look after me, if you'll protect me, if you'll provide for me, if you'll bless me, then you can be my God. And not only that, but I'll give you back 10% of everything that you've given to me. How many of you would take that deal? I'm going to give something to you, but you're going to give me back 10%. What attracts me to that deal? And I just said, oh, I just think of the massive restraint of God. You do everything for me, then I'll let you be my God. and give you 10% of everything that you give to me. Good grief. Well, this is the new setup. It lasts for 20 years. Jacob goes on to Haran. And there he finds Rachel, falls in love with her, makes a deal with her dad to serve him for 7 years so that she can be his wife. And this is a story I hope you all know, so I won't tell it in very much detail. But after working 7 years for Rachel, Rachel has a sister, Leah, and she's not quite as good looking apparently as Rachel was, and Jacob doesn't love her. And so finally he's agreed to work 7 years for Rachel, and they on his wedding night, they have the wedding and the ceremony, but at the last minute, Laban substitutes Leah for Rachel, and he wakes up in the morning and realizes that he's consummated a marriage with the wrong woman. And so he gets a little dose of his own medicine. He was a tricky person, and now he's been tricked. And so he complains to Laban. Laban says, look, the oldest daughter has to be married first. Complete the marriage week with this one, and then I'll give you the other one if you serve me for another 7 years. And so Jacob went for it. He actually married both women at that time, within 7 days of each other, but he owed Laban another 7 years of labor for Rachel. Then after he had married these two women, he also worked another 6 years for the flocks and herds. He was a very hard worker and very resourceful and very creative. And if you read the text, you'll see like the first example of selective breeding in history is probably happening right here, as he chooses, because he has control of the herds, he's trying to produce speckled herds and striped offspring of cattle and sheep. And anyway, but he uses the stronger males whenever they're his cattle and the weaker males when they're Laban's. And anyway, he's very creative, he's very successful, and he becomes wealthier and wealthier and wealthier as he's breeding these sheep and cattle. Also during this time, over a 7 year period, actually, he has 11 sons. And I know you think the math is tricky on that, but the text is clear. In 7 years, these four women produced 11 sons. It's not during 11 years, it's during 7 years. And multiple women were pregnant simultaneously. I bet there were times when four women were pregnant during this stretch. But they had 11 sons in 7 years. And eventually, he's worked. See, he had made a deal to work 7 more years for all of these cattle. But he's afraid that Laban is going to cheat him. And so he calls his wives out into the field and said, look, if we don't run, we may never get away. And so that's what they do. They make arrangements, and they flee from Laban. Well, when Laban finds out, he chases them down, and eventually they make a covenant so that Laban lets Jacob go. Okay, now, this is the second stage of Jacob's career. And it's the stage in which God is useful. And during this season, God was indeed very useful. So turn to chapter 31, 6 through 14. Now, in all of this, you wouldn't know that Jacob had a relationship with God. But yet God is blessing him and taking care of him and providing for him. And we see this explicitly here in chapter 31. I'm going to start reading in verse 6. This is when they're about to flee. You know that I have served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. But now see, he's going to give credit to God here. But God did not permit him to harm me. If he said, the spotted shall be your wages, then all the flock bore spotted. If he said, the striped shall be your wages, then all the flock bore striped. Thus God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. In the breeding season of the flock, I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream that the goats that mated with the flock were striped and spotted and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in a dream, Jacob, and I said, here I am. And he said, lift up your eyes and see. All the goats that mate with the flock are striped and spotted and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise and go out from this land and return to the land of your kindred. So see, at the end of this season, God makes Jacob aware that he really has kept his end of the deal. He has been looking out for and taking care of Jacob and providing for him and protecting him all of this time. And so he tells at the end Jacob to leave, and in obedience, Jacob agrees to leave. So Jacob was aware that God had blessed him, and he's thankful for it. And yet Jacob's behavior throughout this time period suggests a God who helps those who help themselves. Jacob's part was to work as hard as he could. God's part was to bless him for it. Jacob did his part, God did his part, and together they were successful. And so after 20 years in a foreign land, Jacob escapes successfully. And once he finally gets away from Laban, he turns his full thoughts toward home. And now, even though Jacob is excited, he's also fearful because he has unfinished business with Esau. And so, it's been a long time. Maybe he has high hopes. He sends word to Esau that he's coming home, and Esau responds by coming to meet him with 400 men, armed for battle. And this is the way life seems. It's like one crisis after another. He just finally succeeds in handling the situation with Laban, and now here he is facing another crisis, and this one is the most perilous one he's had to face so far. So now look at Genesis 32. And we're going to pick it up in verse 7. The 400 men are coming. Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people who were with him and the flocks and herds and camels into two groups, thinking if Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred that I may do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and faithfulness that you have shown your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. See how far I need to. Oh, yeah. Okay. So this little section just tells Jacob's prayer and how his heart. Now this is the beginning of a change in Jacob. How this is where God moves from being useful to essential. The threat of Esau is the most perilous threat that he has faced so far, and it creates a sense of desperation and need in Jacob that he hadn't had previously. And you know, previously he was like, if you bless me, okay, you'll be my God, but if you don't, it's not that big a deal. But now do you see the note of change, the sense of desperation that, okay, this is what's happening in the life of Jacob right now. And so he's really scared. And what does he do? The way he deals with this, which he had never done before, he makes this prayer, but then he actually gets alone with God. He sends his family across this river, and then he stays alone on the other side. And now I want you to see this encounter with God. He has another encounter with God in verse 22. The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, everything else that he had. And Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. And when the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day is broken." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel." Oh, I might have read further than I wanted to read. One more verse. "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there he blessed him. It is right here where God has moved from being useful to essential. And you see that in the way that Jacob is dealing with God here. His attitude is, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." See, there's no if. Jacob now realizes that God is not optional, that God's blessing is not optional and worth giving a tenth back. He realizes that his life literally depends upon God and his blessing. And if Esau was on his mind as he wrestles with the Lord, the text doesn't mention it. Jacob is not wrestling with God to get delivered from Esau. He absolutely must have God's blessing and God's favor, and he's not trying to make a deal here. God is his only hope. The attitude that he has, see, in the first revelation, Jacob decided that God could be a powerful ally, and Jacob offers a partnership with God. But in the second revelation, Jacob is desperate, and he doesn't say, "If you bless me." He seeks God's blessing as if his life depends on it, and basically says to God, "If you're not going to bless me, you might as well kill me now, because I can't live without you." This is the attitude that Jacob has grown into. God has become essential. And this is precisely what God wanted from Jacob and what he wants from all of us. God brings us relentlessly to the place where we must have him, not just something from him. And there, in that place where God is essential, that's where transformation occurs. And see, because he wouldn't let him go unless he blessed him, God did bless him. But what was the blessing? He didn't say, "I'm going to deliver you from Esau." See, the blessing was nothing less than a new identity. You thought you were Jacob. Now you're going to be called Israel. He gives him a new self. And it's this new self that enables Jacob to have a new relationship with God based on faith. Jacob could never have the relationship with God that God wanted. The only way that Jacob could have the relationship with God that God wanted was for Jacob to be put to death and a new man take his place. The old Jacob was too good at trusting himself. And the blessing that God gave to Jacob was an awareness that Jacob couldn't trust himself, and that he in himself was as good as dead, and the only way that he could have a relationship with God was to die and be born again, to be resurrected as a new person. And that's the blessing that God gives to Jacob. Jacob, the independent man and the deal maker, was transformed into Israel, the dependent man who knew and trusted the living God. Now, we all know that we need to trust God, but Jacob here goes all the way. He was trusting him even when God was useful. But this is different. He wouldn't stop till he had obtained this blessing. And now you're going to see this thing wrap. Look at chapter 32, verse 30. See, this is Jacob's summary statement of that encounter. Okay. I better start in verse 30. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, listen to this, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. Okay, see, when Jacob faced God this second time, he had seen God in a dream before. But when he faced God this second time, the revelation was so profound that he realized in that moment of this wrestling with God and seeing the face of God that he deserved nothing but death. And finally, having realized that he deserved nothing but death, he wasn't worthy of a deal. When he realized he deserved nothing but death, there in that place he was in the proper place to receive mercy. But in a way, see, his life was spared. But in a way, Jacob did die in that encounter with God, and the new man, Israel, was created or resurrected. And why was this a blessing? Because Jacob was too good at trusting himself. Only death and burial and a resurrection as a new man could save him. And the blessing, if you haven't seen it already, of Jacob is a picture for us of the death and the burial and the resurrection of Jesus Christ that produces the same sentence of death in us as we see and encounter the glory of God in the face of the resurrected Christ. It is in that place, broken and humbled before the exalted Lord of heaven and earth. It is in that place, knowing we deserve death and knowing we can't make a deal or earn any blessings, it's in that place that God can finally bless us in the ultimate way. The blessing of giving up all hope in self. And that's why absolute dependence is such a blessing for us. Because we're too good at trusting ourselves. God has to get us into that place where we can trust Him. And through the cross of Christ and the burial of Christ and the resurrection of Christ, we find that we become new creations who love to depend totally and completely on Jesus Christ. Well, let's finish the story. Israel splits his family up between the wives and their children and sends them toward Esau. Then he walks in front of the entire group to face Esau in certain death for the second time in like 12 hours. He just faced certain death from the God who he had offended and who showed him mercy. And now he faces certain death again from Esau, his brother whom he had offended. And so we read the climax of this in Genesis 33, 1 through 4. And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked. And behold, Esau was coming with 400 men. So he divided his children among Leah and Rachel and the two female servants. And he put the servants with their children in front, and Leah with her children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all. He himself went on before them, bowing himself to the ground 7 times. And he came near his brother. Oh, verse 4. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him. And fell on his neck and kissed him. And they wept together. See, 2 times in 12 hours, Jacob effectively experienced death and burial and resurrection. He deserved to die for the way that he had treated his brother. And his brother demonstrates the love and the compassion and the mercy of the prodigal God as he runs to meet his wicked brother, falls on his neck, hugs him, kisses him, weeps over him. Man. And the magnitude of what Esau has done is not lost on Jacob. I want you to see this, and maybe you've never noticed it, but to me this is the most mind-blowing part of this whole passage. 33:10 says, Jacob's trying to convince Esau to receive the gift that he had sent. But Esau says, I have enough, brother. Keep what you have for yourself. Jacob said to him, no, please. If I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand. Listen to this. For I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. Now, some people could say that, and it wouldn't mean very much, right? It could be sort of hyperbole. But what do we know about Jacob's experience? What had just happened? He had seen the face of God. And don't you see the parallels? As Jacob wrestled with the God of heaven and earth, remember how he responded to that? I've seen the face of God and yet I lived. See, in that moment before God, he saw himself as the sinner he was, and the one who had used God and abused God and take advantage of God for his own sake. He saw himself as a sinner deserving of death. And what did he get from God? He got this incredible mercy and this transformation. And then he turns right around and he goes for Esau, whom he deserves death and destruction. And what does he get? He gets mercy and he gets grace. He sees the face of God in the mercy of his brother. And he knew what he was seeing because he had just experienced it. Jacob saw the face of God again, reflected in Esau, as Esau showed mercy to an undeserving sinner. What about you? Who do you trust? God's goal is to bring each of us to the place of absolute dependence on him. And I think back through this story at all the missed opportunities that Jacob had. Jacob could have trusted God in seeking the birthright. I mean, he could have trusted God then, but he didn't. He could have trusted God to secure the blessing. I mean, how do you steal a blessing? It comes from God. You can't steal it. It's insanity, really. But that would have been a perfect time to trust God. If you actually want a blessing, there's only one place to get it. Amen? And you can't steal it. But he didn't. He could have trusted God at the outset of his journey. And he didn't. He entered into a partnership with God, but he didn't trust him. Hey, look, if you do me good, okay, fine. And if not, well, fine. No skin off my teeth. He could have trusted God in the bitter disappointment of Leah. He could have trusted God to make speckled cows. God was doing it, but he wasn't trusting him. What was he trusting? He was trusting these little trees, and he would strip the bark off of them. Could have trusted God to deliver him from Laban, but he makes a plan, and he executes the plan, and he tries to do it with his creativity and his cleverness. See, this whole 20-year season of Jacob's life is marked by self-reliance. He figured it out himself. He relied on himself. He trusted himself. He had faith in himself until God finally brought him to the end of self, and it took an army of 400 men sworn to revenge to break him. And my question is, what's it going to take to break you? God's goal in all of our lives is to bring us to the place of absolute dependence on Christ. And somehow, where somehow we come to that place and we say to Jesus, if you're not going to give me all of yourself, you might as well kill me now, because I know that I cannot live without you. Where are you in this process? Is God irrelevant? Well, that actually doesn't make very much sense, because He is. He's real. He exists. But having come to the place where you know that God exists, is God just useful? Or is God essential? When God is essential, He becomes our only hope. We really must believe Christ when He tells us, apart from me, you can do nothing. And once we become fully convinced of that, and only after we become fully convinced of that, can we move into a life where Christ can literally live His life through us. He is the vine, we are the branches, and He provides the life and produces the fruit. It's only in this place of absolute dependence on Jesus Christ that we can finally say with the Apostle Paul, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. But you can't get to I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength until you come through the place of apart from Him, I can do nothing. I have nothing. I am nothing. And you're my only hope. Let's pray. Jesus, thank you for the sweet example of Jacob. 77 years where you were irrelevant, 20 years where you were useful, and then he lived the last 50 years or so with you being essential. Thank you for not giving up on him. Thank you for continuing to pursue him. And give him a revelation of you, or eventually a revelation that was so profound that he was willing to die to self so that he could have you. That's my prayer for everyone in this room today. There's not a one of us in the room who will be willing to give up on ourselves until we see a deeper, fuller, richer revelation of you. We want to be dependent, but we're actually dependent upon you to make us dependent. God, show us your glory. in the face of Christ. That's when we're willing to turn away from self. Show us your glory. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.